I call this meeting of the House Prevention and State Agency Oversight Committee to order. Welcome to everyone on this beautiful day. Quorum has been established. I meant that, sincerely. Yes, someday. A quorum has been established. Today we are going to continue a discussion on charter schools that we ran out of time for last meeting. And then we will move on to a conversation about feeding our future. As a committee, we have not had an in-depth discussion of that. And I've learned over the last year that many Minnesotans know about feeding our future, but of the broader issue and all the threads on that, most people really are not aware of it. So I thought that was an important conversation to have as a committee. But first, we are going to approve the minutes of April 13th. Representative Vice Chair Anderson, have you had a chance to look at the minutes?
I have, Madam Chair. I move approval.
Representative Anderson moves approval of the minutes of April 13th. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes of April 13th, 2026, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The minutes are adopted. Excellent. Okay, the first item on the agenda is the continuation of the conversation on charter schools. We have one testifier from the public who wishes to speak on this topic, Dr. Bebe Newman. Are you present? Wonderful. Thank you. Please make your way to the testifier table and state your name for the record, and then you'll have 2 minutes for your testimony. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Newman.
Chair Robbins and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to the committee today. I've also provided written testimony for inclusion in the record. My name is Dr. Bebe Newman. I'm a parent and home educator from St. Anthony Village. By training, I hold a bachelor's degree in social work, a master's degree in counselor education and educational psychology, which is a terminal degree in the K-12 school counseling field, a doctorate in counseling psychology, and a Juris Doctor in U.S. law. My professional background is grounded in education, human development, and institutional systems. I'm here to speak to your continued discussion on charter schools from the perspective of a family that chose an alternative educational path because we were seeking alignment. We are a Roman Catholic, first-generation, German-Cameroonian-American blended family. For us, education is not only academic, it's also moral, cultural, and spiritual formation. That responsibility rests with us as parents. What we encountered in our assigned public school environment was not a single issue, it was a pattern where we experienced variability in quality, responsiveness, and transparency that made it difficult to remain engaged as partners in our children's education. Over time, it became clear that the system available to us was not designed to adapt to our children or to meaningfully incorporate the role of families seeking to remain actively responsible for their children's formation. And at times, it felt structured in a way that prioritized institutional stability over responsiveness to families. We adapted around the system. We made the decision to leave before our children were pushed out. That distinction is important because families like mine are not reacting to failure. We are making intentional decisions about how our children are formed. We transitioned to an online charter supported model and have been in that structure for over 7 years. The results have been strong. Our eldest child completed a rigorous academic program, including AP placement coursework, 4 years of French, and PSEO college level classes. He graduated in the top three of a class of approximately 1,000 students and was admitted to his first choice institution, which happened to be Hamline University, on a presidential scholarship. That outcome was not incidental. It was made possible by sustained access to a college preparatory curriculum, flexible pacing, and the ability to fully engage as parents through the charter-supported online model. The pandemic also revealed how demanding it is to support children's learning outside of traditional school structures. Many families experienced that challenge in real time. Our family had already been operating within that model for years, and we can attest that it does require sustained parental engagement, discipline, and responsibility, elements that cannot be outsourced. I want to leave you with this. Charter schools are often discussed as a safety net, but they also serve families who are engaged, proactive, and seeking to remain within the public system while preserving their responsibility to guide their children's academic, moral, and spiritual development. Without this option, I can say with confidence that our eldest would not have had the opportunity to accept a scholarship, much less a presidential one, to his first choice university. When systems cannot accommodate that level of academic achievement, parental engagement, and aligned student development, families leave entirely. This is not just a personal decision. It is a system-level signal that current educational structures are not sufficiently responsive to the full range of families they are meant to serve. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Members, we will now move to the discussion. I just want you to know that Dr. Newman is available for questions, and in the audience we have Joey Senian, who is the Executive Director of Minnesota Charter Schools, Laura Schroeder from Innovative Quality Schools, one of the authorizers, Emily Moore, also an authorizer from Osprey Wild. So if there's any questions for them, they're happy to return to the testifier table and take questions. So is there any discussion on the charter issue as was first raised last week?
Okay, I guess.
Yes. Lead Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll note that unfortunately the two testifiers who came last week were unable to return. I know that we were squeezed for time last week, but it's unfortunate. It felt like we had a good conversation that was getting started and would have continued. So that's just where we are. So maybe I'll just make just a couple of comments then, which are it really strikes me in the packet, Madam Chair, you've assembled some materials submitted, and after the first couple of pages, there's an article by Jeff Mitrot from the Star Tribune that kind of summarizes a series the Star Tribune conducted in 2025 on oversight issues in Minnesota charter schools. That has some pretty shocking information. The one that really jumped out at me is that more than half of compliance reviews conducted over several years documented significant governance problems in the charter school sector. This is not the Education Committee. I think it was like 15 minutes last meeting. We've got just a couple minutes we're going to do now. So I think number one is just to urge our colleagues in the education policy and finance areas to do some digging in this area. And I think jumping off of the terrific investigative work done by Mr. Mitrot and then the points raised by the two testifiers last time. But then just stepping back, Madam Chair, having served on the committee this whole term, this feels like another example where we've got a really important public service that has been privatized. I understand charter schools are public schools, but have been they're being delivered by outside entities. That's a thing that we can be discussing and sorting through. But then when we have the oversight get privatized as well, it feels like that's when we've especially gotten into trouble. Mm-hmm. I think that's true, and I can see some colleagues nodding as well. That's been true in a number of the areas that we've examined as a committee. And I assume that part of the point of this committee is to look at sort of themes and areas we want to direct our colleagues in the policy committees as to how they should be looking at things. And it does seem like one thing we really want to ask them to look at is, hey, first, are you privatizing public services, and exactly what is the purpose of that? Because there's a certain lack of accountability. We are not aware of wrongdoing being committed by public employees or within public agencies. But then, even if you're doing that, are you then outsourcing the oversight of that to, in this case, these authorizers? And what is the reason for that? Because I think we've seen over and over again that there are big concerns. And so those are themes that I think are particularly concerning to me as we examine charter schools and as we kind of fit it into the discussions we've had in other areas as well. And so I appreciate the time, Madam Chair. I wish we could add more, but I do appreciate the willingness to bring this topic up. And it's clearly one we should continue to examine as a body more broadly. Thank you.
Thank you, Lead Pinto. And Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to pick up where Lee Pinto left off, I think as we think about this, our 2 years together here, we have been looking at things, you know, like I would say broad governance issues, oversight, transparency, how do we ensure that the systems that are set up have the right incentive structures. We've been looking at integrity issues, conflicts of interest, internal processes, self-dealing, and sort of things that set up or get close to self-dealing of how our system set up, and then outcomes. And I think we've also been talking about outcomes. Like, we all agree that when we talk, whether we're talking about Medicaid, childcare, and I think the delivery of education, our goal should be to ensure that the Minnesotan at the end of that, in this case kids, gets the, in this case, high quality, transparent education, and the one that we started out when we passed laws and created the systems intending to create. And I think both the testimony we received yesterday or last week, and more importantly, I think the work that the Star Tribune and others have done have shown we have set up a system that has governance issues, integrity issues, and outcome issues. Mm-hmm. And the governance issues that we have seen set up is a lack of transparency and a lack of, what Representative Pinto said, when we set up, and we're about to talk about Feed Our Future, which is another place where we both outsourced the provision of the services, and then Feed Our Future was actually an overseer of the provision of those services, which makes it even harder for government, who sits now two layers up, to actually ensure that there is transparency and integrity. And so I think, like, as we think about what we should be doing in the next set of years and what I think the benefit of a committee like this, an oversight committee, is we can actually see across the silos of whether we're talking about education, whether we're talking about healthcare, whether we're talking about housing, and see some of the structural designs that we have built, experimented with, in some cases have been successful, in some cases, and I'd say in this case, have not. And then I think the question is, so what do we do about it? But in, you know, reading, and I will not, we would be here all day just from the set of articles and testimony we've had, but the conflicts of interest that I think we also see in other spaces, which you're providing a service and maybe you own the building and you're leasing it back to yourself, or you're providing a service and you're contracting with somebody who you have a relationship with to provide, sort of vend out. I've heard about that happening in long-term care too. So when we think about the integrity pieces, I think we got to get serious about that, but I don't know how we fix just those, you know, what happened at Hmong Academy or what happened at the Minnesota Internship Center, without actually going back to this structural question of, if we do not have transparency, if we do not have direct oversight, how we ensure that the long-term integrity of the provision of these services is both incentivized and then enforced. And then I think that the outcomes, and I do, as somebody who served on education finance, I know we have an education policy committee, and this is really their role. But when we look at the research that's been done, the whole idea of having an alternative system was, and as somebody who represents the city of Minneapolis, was there were real concerns about are our public schools, are we set up in a way that are responding to the diverse needs of kids who, in many cases, we have left behind for generations? And I think that was in the 90s, where a lot of the conversations about charter schools, can you have a different governance model? Can you have a different structure? Can you have different incentive structures that leads to better outcomes? And I think the answer that we have seen is at least this very diluted, right, authorizers and then schools, both which are not, do not have the same requirements of our public districts and public schools, has not led to better outcomes. And in that case, if that's the case, we should go back to the outcomes question and say, what are the interventions that we are going to do to ensure that we are providing, you know, strong, consistent, equitable, inclusive, and high quality education? It hasn't been with this model we've created. And that's just the outcomes. There are real allegations, and I think in some cases, in many cases we've seen, MDE has gotten involved, of actual issues when we talk about fraud and self-dealing and conflicts of interest. And I think we need to take them as seriously in the charter school context as we have been taking them in the issue, whether we're talking about Medicaid fraud or anything else. The private provision of services, when we don't have the oversight, we don't have a system that has been set up to incentivize and also enforce integrity has led to what the outcomes we keep getting, which is a slew of individual enforcement actions trying to incentivize behavior, but has not actually fixed the structure. And I don't think anything in these, well, since the 90s, and especially in these more recent media reports, have shown that that the system, there has been some interventions at the state level in 23, 24, 25, I think, but in similar way to, I think, that some of the interventions we have now, we actually have to go upstream and look at the way that the system's set up if we want to get to the root and ensure that we get better outcomes, as opposed to continuing to be downstream and just enforce at the bottom. So I think this is a really good and important conversation. I think that the last year and a half of looking at this in a multitude of spaces has actually given us some tools, and hopefully as this conversation continues in the education committees, and I think in continuing when we're talking about these are all public dollars, we should take these lessons and actually, hopefully in a bipartisan way, do that work.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. Is there any other comments? Representative Nash.
I hate these microphones. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Greenman, you bring up an interesting point about some charter schools, perhaps. I have a charter school in my district. I mentioned it last time we met, and I've since spoken to their executive director, principal. Their outcomes are off the charts. They're turning out students that are scoring much higher than most of Minnesota. So I don't know that the argument around the outcomes are not there is a germane one. And I believe I heard you correct that the conversation around charter schools and authorizers was around governance, integrity, and outcomes. I think that's what I heard you say. The outcomes for Cologne Academy, again, off the charts. And again, prefacing it with not having been on education, I'm still mystified by this whole relationship between MDE and authorizers. MDE is ultimately responsible for the governance of authorizers. So by extension, in a logical argument, they are also responsible for what goes on with everything. And if the lack of oversight is one that you apparently agree with, who's responsible for that lack of oversight? It seems to me that it would fall squarely on the shoulders of MDE. And perhaps I'm oversimplifying the argument, but I don't think I am. By a logical extension, if they are the ones who are ultimately responsible for what happens through the authorizers at the charter schools, then where was the hand of oversight? Why didn't they come in? And I know that I know that you must have some affinity for charter schools, because I think the Pillsbury United Communities got $150,000 when you all were in the trifecta last. So I think that there's an argument to be made that you do see that there's some value here, but I'm still mystified as to how we're trying to deflect away from the responsibility at the core of this argument from MDE having oversight over the authorizers. Because it isn't just a, hey, we're going to bless you and kick you out the door and we're going to wash our hands of it. They still have responsibility, because the executive director last week, or the commissioner, said that was true when I asked that question. That was on the record, and I see him here in the committee room today. If we need to ask him to reiterate that, we can. But he did agree that ultimately it falls to MDE. So I'm still missing the wraparound on your argument, because it is ultimately MDE's responsibility. And if there's a failure, perhaps we should ask why it's theirs.
Thank you. Quickly, Representative Greenman.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate that, and I know that you're new to the committee, Representative Nash, but we have in lots of cases heard from good providers of Medicaid who have said, we are providing better than average services. Why are you doing this payment withhold that may affect us too? So the idea that we need to go upstream and look at these systems isn't, and the systems that is clearly not working. I mean, when we see the kinds of enforcement actions around self-dealing, around lack of governance, around lack of transparency. When we see the closings, and I think it was 400 kids last year who were just left a week without going to school, which I read in an article. But like when we see that kind of stuff, the answer isn't, well, there's some good schools, just like there's some good Medicaid providers. The answer is what structure have we set up? And we did actually create some insulation on purpose, I assume, because we have school boards, and as we talk about, I hear all the time in education, you know, the state and MDE shouldn't control what school boards do. We do have school boards who have independent and transparent and elected leadership who have Chapter 13 obligations. And what we have done is, I think, for policy reasons, set up an alternative oversight structure. And we can bring up MDE if you wanna talk about it. But I don't think it absolves us of the responsibility, which we have set up, again, as we have looked at any time we set up a situation where we have here, over here is the payment structure, and then we have a middle oversight governance structure, and then we have private providers. We have run into this issue of seeing more, like the lack of transparency and the lack of oversight. We've seen more conflicts. And we see that, like the OLA tells us that. And so I don't think you can ignore the same structure. And it's just, it's the structure. It doesn't have anything to do with whether we're talking about the provision of education or we're talking about the provision of healthcare, we're talking about the provision of childcare. When you set up a structure that has lacks the same kind of transparency in other spaces and also creates multiple layers, we have seen a problem, and we've seen that across government.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. And I would like to just add my two cents here. I do think there's a structural problem, but I think it's the problem that Representative Nash raised. We have MDE, which is responsible. Then we've created this layer of the authorizers who then are also responsible. And it's very similar to what we're about to see in Feeding Our Future, where we had MDE responsible, and then we had these site sponsors, like Feeding Our Future, and then the actual sites themselves. And so the structure of having these middlemen who get a cut, I think, is part of the problem, and it makes it hard to have accountability on the individual schools and sites, and it makes it hard to have accountability for the agency. But ultimately, the buck stops with the agency. They have the responsibility, and the genius back in the day, because I'm old enough to remember, was the beauty of charter schools is that they would be allowed to fail. Unlike public schools that you can't close down, if charter schools weren't making it, they would close. And it's painful for those families, but that has happened occasionally. It probably should happen more. But also, we structurally harm charters from the get-go. They've been going with one arm tied behind their back because they're not allowed to own buildings. They were institutionally set up to not have the same support as a traditional public school in the statutes. And I think that was bowing to a political reality, but it has not served the charter movement well. And other states that don't have those similar limitations on charters, I think, have found a more successful model. We were the first, and I think we've lagged now behind other states that have found a better way to manage it. So I actually, you know, share a lot of your concerns. I think there's a lot we can do, and I hope our colleagues on the Education Committee will look at reforming some of the charter laws. Lead Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just a comment in response to what you're saying. It feels like there's a bit of an inherent contradiction here where we talk about the whole point of charters is they can fail, they're independent, we're giving a lot of freedom, and then we have this expectation of MDE. And by the way, that's the charter schools, and then there's the authorizers, and then there's this expectation of MDE that they're going to provide this aggressive oversight that, in fact, we, in the way that we, the legislature, established the system, in fact, does not provide for that authority to the agency. My understanding is, I know that there were a lot of reforms, again, this is in the Education Committee, a lot of reforms enacted in 23 and 24 regarding charter school oversight in a bipartisan way in 2025, and I know that there are reforms that were advanced by MDE, have been advanced, that are currently advancing in the other body have not advanced in our body. I hope that we, if we're pushing to have MDE provide greater oversight over charter schools, I think there's a lot of folks who would not object to that at all. But we can't kind of have, there's that inherent contradiction in there, and we kind of need to decide, in fact, are we going to push to say, listen, they are going to be operating under a lot of control of MDE, and we're going to hold MDE accountable for that, but that's going to be different than the structure that we have right now. So something to consider, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Lead Pinto. Did you have anything else, Representative Nash?
Well, I always have something more, Madam Chair. But
I thought you were waving at me. With
no,
your
I'm never at a loss for words. But I think that there's probably some common ground to be had between Representative Greenman and myself on this. But I ultimately want to point out that when you look at, to use Madam Chair's term, of President Truman's plaque, "The buck stops here." Ultimately, the authorizers are on the hook for, or the MDEs on the hook for oversight of the authorizers. Chair Pinto, you're not saying no.
I mean,
and I think that
you have the floor.
Well, and the commissioner said the very same thing last week, that they have oversight of the authorizers. So when you swim it back upstream, where does the buck stop? It stops with MDE. It does. And I think that let's have an intellectually honest conversation around responsibility. And, you know, Representative Greenman used the word absolution. I'm not trying to absolve anybody of one way or another. I'm trying to say someone needs to take responsibility. We're not trying to wipe the slate clean on somebody. We want to ask, where did it break down, so that we as legislators can say, here is a proposed fix that we want to put into implementation. But ultimately, we have to agree that there is a need to ascertain responsibility for these things. And again, Commissioner's own words, this was that they have oversight over the authorizers. So we could probably beat this drum for a while, but Madam Chair gave me the look that she's ready to move on. So I will be quiet. But I really don't want this to end with the misnomer that MDE is off the hook for this at all, because they are not. They have purview, they have oversight, they have the ability to step in when necessary, and it seems as though that just didn't happen.
All right. Thank you for the good discussion, members, and I do think this is an important topic, and I'm glad my colleagues raised it for this session. So next we're going to turn our attention to a discussion of the Feeding Our Future fraud, and we will have a presentation from the OLA, from a fellow at the Center of the American Experiment and the Department of Education. But first, I want to note for the record that we invited Representative Ilhan Omar to this hearing. We left her two voicemails at the end of March. We've written two letters, one on March 13th and one on March 30th. We also sent an invite on April 15th via her scheduling portal, and we have not had any response. And I do think it's very important to this discussion, and so I'm just going to reference why I wanted to bring her into this conversation, and I know my friends on the other side of the aisle are curious, but so there's a lot of talk in a lot of these reports about how the Feeding Our Future happened because guardrails were taken off the federal school nutrition program. And that is absolutely true. And the first time that happened was in March of 2020. And it was, sorry, I'm looking for the name of the law. But it was in the Families First Coronavirus Pandemic Relief Act, passed in March of 2020. And one of the elements of that bill was something called the Meals Act, which was Representative Ilhan Omar's actual bill that she got incorporated into this larger coronavirus package. And that Meals Act is what took the guardrails down on eligibility, on using the meals no longer had to be consumed on site. They could be for a group, not for an individual. And so the Meals Act really is what loosen the guardrails on the whole federal nutrition program that led to the scandal we have seen that we now call Feeding Our Future, but was actually much broader than that. And these are serious questions, that I actually have for her and her staff, and I will send a follow-up letter after this hearing because I hope that they will respond, because it really does matter for understanding how we got here. And so because she did not respond, I thought it would be good to play a video where she, in her own words, is talking about the Meals Act. And so in lieu of her testimony, we're going to hear from Representative Omar herself from a video that she recorded for Somali TV, and it will have subtitles so we can all understand it. And that was from the spring of 2020. You can play the video.
Can you turn it up? Waxay cuntadooda ka helaan iskoolka kaliya marka waxaan fursad u helnay in aan sharci soo gudbino oo la dhahay Meals Act oo u fududeynayo in waqtigan ay pandemic aan ku jirno oo dhalinyarada iskoolka aanan joogin oo guryahooda ay joogan aanan gaajoonin oo familkoodi wili ay fursad u helaan in cunto ay helaan oo meelo qaarkood laga qaybinayo ay cuntada ka soo qaadan karaan marka aad aan ugu mahadcelinaya safari in ay tahay meelaha city oo diyaarinay cunto maalin kasto en dhalinyarada ciyaalkii iyo familkoodina en ku taaqulaynaayo cuntada city maalintii kaliyo safari waxay ay cunto siisa 2300 oo ciyaal ah iyo familkooda taas waa mid muhiim ah en sida aad u ogtihiin dhalinyaro badan gaajo ku nool wadankaaneeti ama in familkooda fursad u helin in quraac qada iyo casho ay siiso marka in qadada sayti ay meel ka helaan aad ay u muhiimsan tahay in bishan ramadaanka ah oo familyalkeena badan iyagoo aan shaqo haysanin iyagoo aan taaquleyn kale ta helaynin in aynan ka walwalin ciyaalkooda yaryar sidii ay qada ku siin lahaayeen waa muhiim marka waxaan u mahadcelinayaa in safariyo kaleeta iyo dadka badan oo maalin Ilaahay keeno fursad u qaata in ay u volunteer gareeyaan oo ay taaquleeyaan familyalka.
Thank you. So as you saw in the video, she talks about using the Meals Act as a way to make it easier for families to get access to food during the pandemic. And I do plan to follow up with her staff or her directly if she would provide testimony on the record or in a written response about, you know, why she brought that, how that actually materially affected the ability of restaurants like Safari, where this video was filmed, which was the number one meal site sponsor in all of the Feeding Our Future site sponsors. They got $12 million, and they were later indicted. So I think understanding her role in this is very important for the history of understanding this case. And with that, I'll leave it at that.
Madam Chair, just a quick question about that.
Yes, Lee Pinto.
So I saw Congressman Stauber voted for that bill as well. Are you planning to bring him in as well, Madam Chair?
He wasn't the author of the bill.
Okay.
So I think she was the author of the bill, and she brought that to this larger coronavirus relief package. And so I think understanding her intention and her communication with MDE over that issue and with the Department of Agriculture and the feds, I think there's still many unanswered questions about that. So I look forward to following up with her office on that.
And Madam Chair, just quickly, I had the sense from looking at the video that her intention, it seemed pretty clear, which was to make sure that the kids are fed. I don't know if there's sort of more detail you're looking for in particular beyond that, but it seemed sort of clear to me, but I guess we'll see if she's got more to say regarding that.
Absolutely. So, yeah. And I do think that was at least her stated intention in the video, but the video was filmed at Safari Restaurant, which was now charged and convicted for participating in the fraud. And at the time in the video, she references 2,300 meals a day. They eventually got to, I believe, 6,000 or 7,000 meals a day, which defies understanding. And so they were clearly involved with her and her promoting Safari from the beginning. And I think understanding that relationship is part of understanding the larger context of how this happened in Minnesota specifically. Mm-hmm. Other states didn't see the level of nutrition fraud that we did. And so I do look forward to exploring that question. I think it's important for the history of understanding the larger context. Okay. So with that, we also did send an invitation to Attorney General Ellison's office requesting his testimony today. And he also declined to come, and he sent a letter, which was publicly released last night at 5 p.m. So that was the first response we got from him was last night at 5 p.m. And I had also sent a different data request to his office related to Medicaid fraud, which I still have not had a response to on March 6th. So the Attorney General declined to come, saying he had already testified once, and this isn't his jurisdiction because he doesn't have original jurisdiction in these cases, only in Medicaid cases, and that if, you know, we wanted to have prosecutions, it would come from the county attorney or from the feds, and so he really doesn't have anything to add. Although he hastened to say he is doing a small claims case today, so clearly he has civil jurisdiction in all of these fraud cases, and I find it incredibly frustrating that the Attorney General declined to come, because for today's discussion, when we're talking with MDE, he was the lawyer for MDE during this time. And so he absolutely had responsibility for advising and representing the state of Minnesota, and that he very disrespectfully declined to come and said he had nothing to do with this is unconscionable, and I'm very disappointed. It is beneath his office to have responded that way. I know you have something to say, Lee Pinto.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, all I'm going to say is just that the letter that he sent, we'll just ask that it be put on the committee's website, and folks can read the letter for themselves. He does provide background regarding, as I read it anyway, regarding his role, including talking about how he was representing MDE's office was, and working very hard to cut off funding to the fraudsters. But again, folks can read it for themselves. We'll just ask to be posted. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, we will post it. And it's also, he put it on his own Twitter page yesterday, so it's been out there for a few hours. And I would like just to note for the record, since we're putting things on the record, and I will make sure these are added as well, that the Attorney General has had very conflicting statements on his involvement in Feeding Our Future. And so when the first announcements were coming out in September of 2022, he put out a statement, quote, he and his office have been, quote, deeply involved for 2 years in holding Feeding Our Future accountable. This was September of 2022. And, quote, I'm not seeing it, but he claims that, oh yes, here it is. MDE and the Attorney General's office brought their suspicions of fraud to the FBI and fully cooperated with the investigation that they jump-started. And so he's saying this in February of 2022, but then when he comes to testify in our committee last year in April of 2025, he then follows up with when there had been a recording about him meeting with the Feeding Our Future, some of whom were later defendants, in December of 2021, and we discussed that with him. He put out an op-ed saying in January of 2022, a month after his meeting with the people involved in Feeding Our Future and that recording, my office got our first indication from the FBI of the scale of Feeding Our Future's illegal conduct. So in 2022, he's saying they led and they brought it forward and they were in charge. And then in April of 2025, he said, oh, we had no idea. We got our first indication in January of 2022, right when the warrants came out. So his contradictory statements on this need to be addressed, again, for the public record, and I'm very disappointed that he is not here to answer these questions.
Madam Chair, one quick clarification, if I may.
Thank you.
I think I'm realizing part of the confusion here. The letter from the Attorney General references your request to him to testify, and I wasn't part of that exchange, so I don't know, but the way he's quoting this is that it was a request to provide, quote, an update on the prosecutions of the Feeding Our Futures cases, and then also information on how many cases have been processed, procedures for prosecution. So his office's role in civil matters relating to this, the letter gets into, he's referenced that a number of times, but it seems like the request to him to testify today related to the prosecution of the cases, and as he points out in the letter, that's not a role the Attorney General's office has been involved in the case. That might at least help to explain some of the confusion here. Thank you.
Thank you. It may, but the request was for him to come and testify about matters relating to Feeding Our Future. And when he was the attorney representing the Department of Education, and he's not here, it's incredibly frustrating. But we will move on. So with that, I am happy to welcome to the committee Catherine Thiessen. She is the Deputy Legislative Auditor, and she is going to discuss a Legislative Auditor report from June of 2024 that did an absolute incredible public service of a deep dive with many appendices on what the OLA found regarding Feeding Our Future. And it's really an important piece of research that gets to a broad set of questions for us. So with that, we welcome you, Ms. Thiessen. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Catherine Thiessen, and
sorry about that.
Don't worry, Madam Chair. It's a challenging name to get correct. For the record, my name is Catherine Thiessen, and I am a Deputy Legislative Auditor for the Office of the Legislative Auditor. I oversee our Special Reviews Division. As Madam Chair said, I've been asked to provide this committee a short summary of a special review we released in June of 2024. Concerning the Department of Education's oversight of Feeding Our Future. Before I get into our findings and recommendations, I do want to say that, you know, when bad actors collude with the intent to commit fraud, it can be really difficult to discover and stop the fraud. And the best defense against fraud is effective oversight and strong internal controls. Taken together, effective oversight and strong internal controls makes it difficult for bad actors to commit fraud, but it also ensures that public funds are used as intended and produce the outcomes desired by the legislature. And this is why OLA focuses so intently on oversight and controls, and this too was the focus of this special review. Until early 2022, Feeding Our Future was a sponsor for two federal nutrition programs, the Child and Adult Care Food Program, or CACFP, and the Summer Food Service Program, or SFSP. CACFP provides reimbursements for meals and snacks that are served to eligible children and adults enrolled at participating child care centers, after school care programs, and adult daycare centers, among other locations. And this program generally operates year round. SFSP provides reimbursements for meals and snacks served to eligible children at places like summer camps, located in low-income areas, and this program generally operates when school is not in session, such as during summer months or during unexpected school closures, such as with the COVID-19 pandemic. In CACFP and SFSP, food is served to eligible children and adults at locations called sites. Sites are responsible for verifying the eligibility of participants and serving meals and snacks, among other things. Sponsors are the entities responsible for overseeing sites, including monitoring sites for compliance with program requirements. Sponsors retain a percentage of reimbursements to cover the costs of providing or facilitating food service and ensuring compliance with federal program rules, among other responsibilities. State agencies, in turn, are responsible for overseeing sponsors' compliance with applicable state and federal laws, including through ongoing monitoring. And finally, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, oversees and reimburses state agencies, writes federal rules, and evaluates state agency performance. In this review, we had concluded that MDE's oversight of Feeding Our Future was inadequate. And frankly, we believe that its inadequate oversight created opportunities for fraud. In our review, we identified numerous instances when MDE did not provide adequate oversight, especially given information it had in its possession or should have obtained but did not. These instances span all of MDE's key oversight mechanisms, as well as the nearly 4 years from 2018 to 2022, during which Feeding Our Future was operating as a sponsor and receiving public funds. Today I'm going to present briefly select findings from three key themes. First, that MDE failed to act on warning signs known to the department prior to the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic. Second, that MDE did not effectively exercise its authority to hold Feeding Our Future accountable to program requirements. And third, that MDE was ill-prepared to respond to issues it encountered with Feeding Our Future. Feeding Our Future began operating as a sponsor in CACFP in 2018. Later in 2022, it became a sponsor in SFSP. Between 2018 and 2021, Feeding Our Future's operation grew at a significant rate, especially in the year following the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic. At its peak, MDE paid Feeding Our Future nearly $32 million for approximately 12 million meals and snacks the organization purportedly served in April of 2021. This was 87 times more than what Feeding Our Future, or MDE, had paid Feeding Our Future in April of 2020. But compared to other sponsors, Feeding Our Future was an outlier both before and after the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. By October 2019, Feeding Our Future already had 6 times the number of CACFP sites than the average sponsor that also had multiple sites. At that time, Feeding Our Future had 73 CACFP sites and the average multi-site sponsor had 12. Then during the COVID-19 pandemic, the amount of federal funds that MDE distributed to all sponsors increased by roughly 400%. However, the total funds received by Feeding Our Future in that same time period increased by roughly 2,800%. And in fiscal year 2021, roughly 4 out of every $10 distributed to nonprofit sponsors in these two programs went to Feeding Our Future and its sites. On top of all of that, by the start of the pandemic in March of 2020, MDE had reason to be concerned about Feeding Our Future's compliance with program regulations. In December of 2018, MDE conducted an administrative review of Feeding Our Future's operations. This is an on-site, regularly scheduled review of sponsors. We describe the findings on pages 38 to 40 in Exhibit 3.3 of the report. And these findings, many of them relate to issues that increase the risk for fraud. For example, MDE found that one or more of the 4 sites included in the review had incorrectly inflated average daily attendance and claimed unallowable food service expenses, among other things. In addition to MDE's findings at Feeding Our Future sites, several other findings indicated deficiencies in the ability of Feeding Our Future to manage its program. For example, it found MDE had found that Feeding Our Future had failed to ensure its sites took action to correct issues that Feeding Our Future itself had identified, as well as improperly verified meal claims from sites. While a follow-up was warranted in this case, MDE did not conduct one. Moving next to findings related to ineffective exercise of authority. Despite signs that Feeding Our Future might not have been in full compliance with the program, MDE didn't effectively use its authority. So I wanted to touch first on MDE's key oversight responsibilities. 2 activities that occur on a regular schedule are application reviews and administrative reviews. Sponsors apply to participate in these programs each year, and MDE is responsible for determining the eligibility of those sponsors. Administrative reviews include a periodic in-depth monitoring of sponsors. They can include site visits to a percentage of sponsor sites, observations of meal and snack service, and then reviews of the sponsor's records. Another key oversight is investigating complaints and irregularities in these 2 programs. In addition to requiring MDE to conduct investigations, federal regulations require the department to take appropriate actions to correct irregularities. And finally, MDE is required by federal law to initiate an administrative serious deficiency process when it identifies serious issues with sponsors' observations, or operations, excuse me. Some of these serious deficiencies could include failing to properly monitor sites, claiming reimbursements for meals and snacks not served, or submitting false information on the sponsor's application. Sponsors are required to correct serious deficiencies in order to continue operating in the program. But we found that MDE repeatedly approved Feeding Our Futures annual applications despite serious concerns. We state in the report that MDE missed opportunities to hold Feeding Our Future to standards outlined in law when it approved several applications, even after requesting additional information from Feeding Our Future and not receiving it. MDE also did not appropriately investigate complaints involving Feeding Our Future. We found that MDE did not investigate some complaints, despite their seriousness and the frequency at which they received similar complaints. And we also found that when MDE decided to investigate complaints, investigations were inadequate. For example, MDE inappropriately asked Feeding Our Future to investigate complaints about itself. And finally, we found that MDE did not verify information provided by Feeding Our Future along with its annual applications before closing investigations or deferring a serious deficiency process in 2021. And finally, we concluded that the findings in our report were symptoms of a department that was ill-prepared to respond to the issues it encountered with Feeding Our Future. When we questioned its oversight of Feeding Our Future, MDE officials told us that many things prevented it from taking action based on its concerns about Feeding Our Future's participation in federal nutrition programs, including operational challenges caused by COVID-19 pandemic-related waivers, including a lack of clear and written guidance provided by USDA, a lack of rulemaking authority under state law. But to these points, we found that it was MDE's choices that made the COVID-19 pandemic-related waivers a source of reduced oversight, not the waivers themselves. We think that the flexibility that the waivers provided to MDE in relation to its monitoring responsibilities should have made focusing on high-risk sponsors like Feeding Our Future easier and not harder. We also concluded that MDE had the authority to take steps to address issues it identified with Feeding Our Future, regardless of a lack of detail in USDA guidance, and to the extent to which MDE believed it needed additional regulatory authority to strengthen its ability to take actions against bad actors. It had the obligation to seek legislative action to obtain that authority. Additionally, the Minnesota Court of Appeals put MDE on notice back in 2017 that it needed to codify certain procedures in its state administrative rules, but MDE neither requested changes to statutes nor pursued additional rulemaking authority. We had a number of recommendations in this report, including one to the legislature, that it establish criteria and statute or give MDE the authority to conduct rulemaking to establish application criteria, and I'm happy to report that the 2023 and the 2025 legislature did pass statutes that are responsive to this recommendation. We also recommended that MDE take additional steps to verify information submitted by sponsors and place a greater emphasis on program integrity and risk-based monitoring in the event that waivers or oversight requirements are waived again in the future. We also made a number of recommendations to MDE regarding its complaint investigation procedures, including prioritizing independent fact-finding. With that, Madam Chair, I have concluded my presentation, but I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your presentation. I think we'll hold questions until we hear from some of the other presenters. Next up, I believe we have Bill Glahn, a policy fellow from Center of the American Experiment on Zoom. Are you there, Mr. Glahn?
Yeah. Yes, I am. I'm trying to get my stuff working here. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. So,
okay. And you can see me. All right.
Now we can. Yes. Yeah, so please state your name for the record to begin your testimony.
My name is Bill Glahn, G-L-A-H-N. I'm a policy fellow with the center of the American experiment. And Madam Chair, if I may, I'd like to pick up with your introduction of Attorney General Ellison's letter sending his regrets to appearing before your committee today. As you and Representative Pinto pointed out, he talked about the jurisdiction or lack thereof that his office has over certain criminal cases, and talking about the relationship between his office and the feds and criminal prosecutions. What I took from that was a request from Attorney General Ellison to expand his authority, to give him more original jurisdiction to bring criminal cases against fraudsters. And we still have a couple of weeks left of the session, so perhaps a bill could be brought forward, sent to the Rules Committee, get a waiver, and make this thing happen so that Attorney General Ellison and his successors have this jurisdiction to bring these cases, and that coupled with some extensions of the statute of limitations on fraud against taxpayers would result in more prosecutions. I think citizens and taxpayers would appreciate that. And for the record, Madam Chair, I also was invited to testify in front of your committee via email, and frankly, I didn't have any confusion over what the subject was. I understood that I was being asked to testify regarding civil prosecutions that the Attorney General has or has not undertaken against fraudsters, particularly in the Feeding Our Future case. So I just want to, again, using Attorney General Ellison's letter as a jumping off point, talk about some of the civil litigation he's engaged in over the past 4 years regarding Feeding Our Future and other related frauds. First of all, he references his two lawsuits against Feeding Our Future, civil cases, where one, acting in his capacity as the lead regulator of charities, nonprofits, he sought the dissolution of the Feeding Our Future nonprofit. And we've mentioned a lot of the litigation originated by Feeding Our Future, for which Attorney General Ellison served as the lead lawyer for the Department of Education. He actually sought in a separate lawsuit, he mentions in his letter, recovery of litigation costs, that the theory being that Feeding Our Future engaged in this massive fraud, was not litigating in good faith, caused taxpayers to expend dollars defending the Department of Education, and he sought to claw that back. Of course, by the time he filed his civil lawsuit in state court, the feds had already seized any asset of any value of Feeding Our Future. So there was nothing left. There was no blood left in that stone to recover. So that has come to naught. But there are a couple of other lawsuits worth mentioning that deal with other nonprofits engaged in what we call, writ large, the Feeding Our Future scandal. Feeding Our Future itself, according to court records, took something like $246 million out of free food programs during its lifetime, but concentrated on those COVID years of 2020 and 2021. Attorney General Ellison mentions in his letter litigation that he filed, coincidentally going to court today, a jury trial involving another lawsuit, a false claims lawsuit that the Attorney General filed on behalf of the Department of Education against a vendor in the free food program. And I kind of dug into that a little bit. Just wanted to give you the case number, 27-CV223107, where the Department of Education is suing some individuals and a corporate entity that were vendors to another free food nonprofit called Partners in Nutrition. We've all heard of Feeding Our Future, but Partners in Nutrition was the second largest free food nonprofit during those years, 2020 and 2021. They were also shut down by the feds, by the State Department of Education, been mentioned by the feds in both of the courtroom trials that have occurred in the case. But the nonprofit itself, Partners in Nutrition, and also has never been charged with anything, nor have any of its corporate officers been criminally charged in any court case, but they have been the plaintiffs in a number of lawsuits against the state of Minnesota over the years, ultimately all of which they lost, but of course the Attorney General, Department of Education, racked up a big legal fees trying to defend itself. And as far as I can tell, the Attorney General has never filed a lawsuit to dissolve that corporation, nor has the Attorney General ever filed a lawsuit to claw back any of those litigation. So I thought it curious he mentions this False Claims Act a trial that was going to court this morning in Hennepin County Court, and that he wasn't suing the Partners in Nutrition corporate entity, which is, of course, the entity with which the Department of Education has its contract. We all talked about, and we heard from the legislative auditor, that these nonprofits like Partners in Nutrition and Feeding Our Future act as middlemen between the vendors who actually provide meals or don't provide meals in many cases to children and the taxpayers who are represented by the Department of Education. So Partners in Nutrition isn't being sued in this, but this vendor is. And I kind of dug into it, and it's this litigation actually dates from September 2022. It predates a week or two before the feds filed their first round of indictments in the criminal cases. And what's interesting is this isn't something that Attorney General Ellison and his investigators came up with. This isn't something the Department of Education came up with. In fact, the entire case centers around $106,000 in a unclaimed property account held at Wells Fargo Bank. At some point, Wells Fargo contacted MDE saying, hey, we have this unclaimed property that has something to do with your food program. Basically, come and get it. And this $106,000 has been the subject of a number of lawsuits, claims and counterclaims over who owns it. I do hope that Attorney General prevails as a taxpayer and a citizen. I would hope he could claw back the $106,000. But after 4 years of litigation, I'm despairing that the state of Minnesota is going to come out net ahead on the deal. So he made it sound in his letter that this was a very common effect. Yes, it just so happens we have another one of these up today. But I can't find another example where the Attorney General has sued a food vendor for, I can't use the word defrauding because it's a civil lawsuit, misspending or misappropriating, whatever the correct word is. But clearly he has the power. The Attorney General has the power to civilly go after vendors for recovery of dollars that were taken out of the food program. Not criminal charges, but a civil lawsuit. And it calls to mind another almost famous civil lawsuit that the Attorney General did file against an entity known as Gargar Family Services. Its legal name is Youth Leadership Academy. It was also shut down by the State Department of Education. It's been mentioned in court documents and Feeding Our Future trials, but the corporation itself, Gargar, neither it nor any of its corporate officers have been charged with any criminal wrongdoing. Now, the corporate officers have all been banned from the food program, at least for 7 years, and the entity was shut down. Again, Youth Leadership Academy, Gargar Family Services, has itself filed a number of lawsuits against the state of Minnesota, against the Department of Education, for which the Attorney General is the attorney of record. He hasn't sued them for recovery of any of that money or any of the money that they took from the food program. He sued them as the regulator of charities to dissolve their charity. It doesn't sound like they put up any kind of a fight against it. That is, Gargar didn't fight it. The corporation has been dissolved. It no longer exists. But if you read the original complaint filed by the Attorney General against Gargar, it goes into some detail about their activities as a food vendor. In fact, he documents, naming names, $3.4 million that Gargar did in business with two corporate entities that have been charged criminally in the Feeding Our Future case, naming individuals who would later plead guilty in the Feeding Our Future crimes, including a couple who have yet to be sentenced. So he documents $3.4 million of business transactions between this nonprofit Gargar and food fraudsters who would later plead guilty. But again, he's never sought to recover any money on behalf of taxpayers from this corporate entity. But he's convinced me, through the detail he included in this civil lawsuit, that this nonprofit is guilty of something, maybe not criminal conduct, but conduct worth mentioning the dollar amounts over. And he mentions in the same civil lawsuit the Attorney General does, the COO and CEO of Gargar Family Services. And they have an interesting backstory. The CEO is an individual who has donated
or at least prior to this lawsuit being filed in 2024, donated more than $4,000 to the reelection campaign of Keith Ellison for Attorney General. The COO of the organization donated $1,500 to Keith Ellison's reelection campaign. And a third board member, which you probably all know perhaps personally, Mark Ritchie, who served as a Democrat, as a Secretary of State for the state of Minnesota for a term or two. He was a board member of Gargar Family Services, and he's donated another $500 to Keith Ellison's reelection campaign before this lawsuit was filed. That totals more than $6,000 of campaign donations. And he filed this lawsuit, got the company dissolved. That was in 2024. In 2025, the CEO donated another $400 to the reelection campaign. I guess no hard feelings between her and Keith Ellison. But as far as I can determine, Keith Ellison and his campaign have never returned any of the $6,000 donated by officers of this nonprofit, Gargar Family Services, that Keith Ellison and his attorneys felt the need to sue and dissolve their existence of. So again, you know, I would put it under the bucket of selective prosecution, people being sued, people not being sued, people being sued, but money damages not being sought. In fact, Attorney General Ellison mentions filing a couple of dozen lawsuits against nonprofits involved in the Feeding Our Future scam for that purpose, dissolution of their corporate entity as the regulator of charities for the state of Minnesota. I can only find one instance where he settled for any monetary value, and he got $1,000 off of one of the employees of one of these who was never charged criminally. But I can only find $1,000 in recovery through these lawsuits for the corporate dissolution, whereas collectively the U.S. attorney has estimated at least $300 million have been stolen from the people they're prosecuting, and perhaps another $200 million from people they haven't prosecuted. So that's from the U.S. Attorney's Office. And I just wanted to highlight for the committee some of the civil litigation that the Attorney General has undertaken, where he has undertaken quite a bit of it. But what frustrates me as a taxpayer is the lack of a request for monetary damages. And he puts out press releases, that is the Attorney General's office, almost on a daily basis touting how many millions of dollars he's recovered in damages or settlements with private entities that he has sued in his capacity as Attorney General. I think either perhaps it needs a change in statute or just more staff or more aggressive attitude on behalf of the Attorney General. There are millions and millions of dollars in recovery that he is better positioned than anybody in state or federal government to go after.
Thank you, Mr. Glahn. We appreciate it. And I think if you can stand by, there may be questions. For now, we will go to Maureen Halden, Deputy Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Education. While she's coming to the testifier table, I'll let you know, Representative or Mr. Glahn, that there looked like some bipartisan interest in your suggestion to give the Attorney General more jurisdiction. So, Lead Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I guess the thing that jumped out at me was that I know the Attorney General's office has been trying to get additional funding for the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. We know it's one of the most efficient in the country, but they're held back right now in terms of the dollars they can recover for us and the Medicaid fraudsters they can go after. So I guess I'm hearing there may be Center of the American Experiment support for that, I'm hoping, and that's something I'm hoping we can all push for. So let's get them the funding they need. Thank you.
Thank you, Lead Pinto. And I note for the record that I sent the Attorney General on March 6th a list of questions about what he has prosecuted and recovered in the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, and I have not to hear from him, but that would matter for our deliberation, so I hope he responds to that. All right. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Halden. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Robbins and members. Thank you. My name is Maureen Halden, and I serve as Deputy Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Education. I'm grateful for this opportunity to provide an overview of these federal community nutrition programs that MDE administers and a summary of MDE's response to Feeding Our Future. Continually grateful for the collaborative partnership with the Office of the Legislative Auditor and their excellent work, as always. MDE is deeply committed to preventing fraud and preventing and detecting fraud, waste, and abuse in all our programs. And much has changed at MDE in the past 5 to 6 years. We have worked hard over the past several years to put strong internal controls and effective oversight tools in place to ensure that we're safeguarding public funds and minimizing opportunities for bad actors to misuse or take advantage of our public resources. We now have a robust agency-wide approach to preventing fraud, waste, and abuse. This includes our Office of the Inspector General. We are continuously grateful to the legislature for creating this office and for the key legislative authority that the legislature added in 2024. This ensures that we have a dedicated expert investigative team here at MDE with knowledge of MDE programs and strong working relationships with our MDE program areas. And this work has just been critical for preventing fraud, waste, and abuse. Oversight of MDE's complex programs, as you've heard about the nutrition programs, demands specialized expertise of our OIG. They've built trusted working relationships across our agency to be able to facilitate timely and comprehensive information sharing and swift corrective actions, including in the nutrition space. Our OIG, as of April 15th, our OIG has received 412 complaints, closed 170 complaints. We have 234 cases under investigation, including 66 full investigations. 21 of those investigations have been in direct collaboration and cooperation with law enforcement. We've issued 20 temporary sanctions, and that amounts to about $1.1 million in program savings. In addition to our statewide OIG, we've just really invested in an agency-wide culture of fraud prevention as we are leading and continuing to build this culture that where we emphasize with all of our staff that it is everyone's responsibility to prevent and detect fraud, waste, and abuse. We do this through agency-wide trainings, cross-division program integrity work and improvement of internal controls, a leader focus on fraud prevention and regular check-ins on program integrity work. And our OIG, again, is a key part of this. Often our program areas request specifically to have our OIG come do trainings for them, and we have our OIG lead agency-wide trainings that required staff meetings regularly. We also have really increased and gotten more robust with our use of our regulatory tools, and that's something that kind of you heard in the discussion of what happened with Feeding Our Future. With the support of our Office of General Counsel, which was established in 2023, we can confidently and robustly use our regulatory and program area tools and rules specific to each program, grants cancellation, and defend them upon appeal. And as you heard from Mr. Glon, there are often a wide array of legal actions challenging our use of regulatory tools. We also use intra and interagency coordination. In 2024, the legislature granted our OIG and the commissioner the authority to exclude entities that have been excluded from MDE programs by other MDE programs. And we can also do that with other agency exclusions. And so we do a lot of intra-agency and cross-agency collaboration. And finally, we are always focused on improving our regulatory authorities in specific program areas. And we've sought and attained program integrity improvements in statute in areas like nutrition and charters. So I next plan to kind of provide an overview of the federal community nutrition programs that we administer, but the OLA did a great job. So I'm going to skip that part.
Excellent.
And just give you just two comments about those programs, I would say, as we've administered them over the years. First, and it's important to kind of situate them as reimbursement programs, and that means that under the federal regs, the approval happens through the site and sponsor applications, and then sites are really free to begin submitting the meal counts to the sponsor, who's then responsible for making sure that they are valid and submitting them along to the state, who is responsible for making the reimbursement payment. The federal regulations do not include a requirement that state agencies collect documentation before claims are paid, as really the burden under the regulations rests under the federal regs rests primarily with sponsors. The other thing I would say about them is that there's really a focus from the way the federal program is set up on healthy nutritious meals for children. The regulations are incredibly detailed about the meal pattern, which is what food needs to be included in each meal. And one of the things and challenges, honestly, that we've encountered is that it's easier to deny a claim for reimbursement for a meal that served the wrong kind of rice, like unenriched rice instead of enriched rice, than to deny meal claim reimbursements for concerns about whether the meals were actually served. And that's a function of kind of where the focus is in the federal regs. With that, I will turn to kind of a summary of, and you heard much of this from the OLA, but also I'll do my best to, again, not repeat what you've already heard, because their timeline is very thorough and we don't dispute it. But I will just start with saying, with regard to Feeding Our Future, what happened was a travesty, and it was a coordinated, brazen abuse of these nutrition programs that exist to serve healthy, nutritious meals to children in low-income households. And our oversight of these programs has been reviewed frequently in the past several years, and we treat every single review and discussion about it as a really valuable continuous improvement tool. So thank you for the chance to talk about it again today. And so I'm happy to kind of review the committee with a short summary of the timeline of what happened.
Thank you. You know, I think we'll probably get to that as just through the questioning. Okay. So if you wouldn't mind, I have a growing list and we only have a half hour, so I'm going to turn to Representative Altendorf. Sorry, you're first on the list here.
No, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just didn't know we were getting to questions yet. But to MDE, you know, and again, because we have time, or we're running out of time, but the Office of Legislative Auditor did a great job, as you said, on the June 2024 report. And I would just recommend to the public to take a look at that. Starting on page 79, you know, what caught my eye is this timeline of events. And it starts with Feeding Our Future applying for aid. Initially, ironically, they were denied. Then they went through an appeals. They were approved. But if you follow the timeline, there is incident after incident complaints that were given to MDE. Again, don't want to go through all of them, but, you know, starting June 2018 would be the first complaint, and then it went on, and most of these complaints were about the managerial. June of 2019, there was even kickback, so this is all prior to what happened during COVID-19. In the Oversight Committee notes, the OLA, you know, referenced that MDE, they had the choice. They had to make choices. They lacked the oversight. MDE had the authority, and MDE had the obligation to act, and they did not. So my question to MDE is, who was making those choices at the time?
Ms. Halden.
Thank you so much, Representative Chair Robbins, and I appreciate your detailed attention to the timeline. You know, I joined the department in 2024, and so I wasn't, unfortunately for all of you probably, I wasn't there. And so decisions about kind of how to use regulatory authorities, it would probably have depended on whether it was involving a legal matter. Because one of the things, as you know from your well reading of the timeline, is that really, the story of FOF starts in 2016 with, as Mr. Glahn mentioned, the Partners in Nutrition sponsor, where they sought to become a sponsor in the program. MDE tried to keep them out because we found that they were not financially viable. They challenged that in court. That got to the Minnesota Court of Appeals, which found that MDE did not have the authority to impose a financial viability standard on sponsors because that's not in the federal regs. And then it was that, so then as you correctly noted, when FOF tried to become a sponsor, the nutrition program initially denied that application, but the appeals panel reversed it on the same basis as that 2017 Court of Appeals decision. And so from that moment on, much of the interpretation about our regulatory authorities were honestly under litigation. And as you know, FOF both started threatening to sue in early 2020 and then did sue in November of 2020. And so I guess my point is that some of those decisions might lie in it, like in conversations with about how to handle litigation. Now, this is where, again, establishing our, and when our new leadership established the Office of General Counsel in 2023, now we have an in-house dedicated legal team. We have, under the governor's fraud prevention package last year, you funded two additional program integrity-focused attorneys, one who comes to us with an incredible, remarkable set of experience in these specific programs. And so now our nutrition team has the benefit of in-house legal counsel to do a couple things. First, to help them see the possibilities of how to use the regulations to assert robust oversight. And second, to ensure that when we are making those choices and doing that now, they're ready to stand up on appeal. And I would note that we've done 10 different serious deficiencies since 2024, and most of them have been appealed. And we have been successful in sustaining those appeals. And that wasn't the story back with Penn. And
and who was your lawyer at that point? Who was the lawyer for the department when they weren't being successful?
So we are represented in all of our litigation by the Attorney General's office.
Yeah. Thank you. So Representative Eltendorf, you had another question.
I guess just follow up. Thank you. That's my question is, is there not record of who made these decisions? Because there was over 30 valid complaints. This was over many years, many red flags, as noted by the OLA report. And I think what the public wants to know is why was the money not shut off? Because this was voluntary. The MDE continued to pay. It was not ordered by the court, but it was continued to pay. And that's the questions that the public wants to know. Is why was the funding not shut off with this many red flags? And literally, you know, to the public, 15 pages of a timeline is, I mean, this is not a small number, and MDE continued to make those payments with all these. So thank you, Madam Chair.
So do you care to respond? Why wasn't the payment shut off?
Sure. Thank you, Representative and Chair Robbins. And you brought up two pieces that I think are illustrated or kind of I want to respond to similarly. So the first, you brought up the complaints, and then also kind of why was it not shut off. So under the federal nutrition regs, again, they don't make it very easy to shut things off. There is a suspension procedure, which is rarely used. It's basically like if a governor or a president set or a child care center has an imminent threat of health and safety, then we can use that suspension. Otherwise, it's basically serious deficiency, which is really designed to keep sponsors in the program. It gives them ample opportunities to fix via corrective action, and it can take many months to get to the point where you can terminate an entity based through the serious deficiency program process. Now, there is an option for suspension when there's fraud. But the challenge being, and this is again why we are so grateful for the oversight tool of our OIG, is that fraud is a legal standard of criminal conduct. And our federal nutrition team, they are not in criminal investigators. They're operating a federal community nutrition program, and that's really focused on the content of the meals. And so a lot of our folks are focused on kind of the oversight responsibilities that we have and nutrition. And so now that we have, at the time, we didn't have a team that could do a criminal investigation into whether the elements of fraud had been met in order to use that fraud suspension option that's not very well defined under the regs. Now we do. And that, I think, is a really big difference for how we're able to handle things now given our statewide OIG. Same thing for the complaints. Many of those complaints were coming in from people that have now been convicted or pled out in the aftermath. The complaints about kickbacks against each other. And we didn't have a team that has familiarity with law enforcement. The February 2019.
If you didn't have the people, why didn't you reach out to the BCA? Like, saying you don't have the team, you're just going to let fraud go is not acceptable.
Thank you, Chair Robbins. I appreciate that question. What we did do, and honestly, I think most states maybe don't have the team. I'm not totally sure. But the structure that does exist to deal with this kind of problem is the USDA OIG. And that is the path that our team pursued. As soon as we started seeing the rapid growth of meal claims, about 60 days after they're supposed to come in the late summer of 2020, we reached out to our USDA partners. Can you help us? What this looks off, what are we supposed to do here? We didn't get very much help. So then we asked them for the contact information for USDA OIG, which they gave us. And we started contacting USDA OIG in, I think, October 2020. And honestly, we didn't get much help from them. We provided them information in November 2020, continued to provide follow-up information, and ultimately, I think our team presumed that I'm not sure if they know exactly what happened with that. We now know that the USDA OIG did not investigate, that is how the federal regulations and the federal program sets up to make sure that there is an entity with that criminal investigative responsibility that can support states that are operating the programs. And so it's a good question, but we tried the USDA OIG, which is, you know, was our understanding of who was there to help us.
Thank you. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There is a lot of questions related to the timeline. One of those questions is who made the decision to resume payments in April of 2021?
Ms. Holden.
Thank you, Representative and Chair Robbins. Off the top of my head, I'm not specifically sure who exactly made that decision. It would have been an MDE decision.
Thank you. Presumably up to the commissioner level?
Chair Robbins, I don't have that level of information. I wasn't here at the time.
Thank you. Representative Schultz.
Madam Chair, it is difficult given that the agencies, the Attorney General who is representing the agencies, didn't send us people here today to share what happened. They're sending us someone who came on board in 2024 for things that happened in 2021. And that's the attorney that represented the agency. It is the agency staff themselves are not here today. Frankly, this is an example of the executive branch here in the state of Minnesota standing in the way of the legislative branch and the oversight responsibilities that we duly have, especially when it relates to fraud. And just for the record here, the Feeding Our Future scandal, according to the acting U.S. attorney in last June, said that this could be up to $500 million just in the Feeding Our Future scandal. That's not mentioning Partners in Nutrition. So the reason I bring that up and why I'm seeking clarity here is Minnesotans demand to know who made the decision. Who made the decision based upon what guidance that payment should return in April of 2021? A full, let's see, is that 9 months? 9 months before the sites were raided by the FBI in April of 2021. Who made the decision? On whose guidance? Was that the guidance from the Attorney General? And I guess I'll make that my next question. Was that on guidance from the Attorney General?
Ms. Alden.
Thank you, Representative, and thank you, Chair Robbins. And just to be clear, I'm here on behalf of MDE, not the Attorney General's office. With regard to who, on whose guidance?
Madam Chair.
Representative Schultz.
I will clarify this really quickly so that we don't have any more obfuscation here. This was, this came directly from Judge Guffman in response to statements made by the governor saying that that it was the courts that said that this needed, that this needed to return, that the payments needed to return. And he specifically said in a press, this being Judge Guffman in September of 2022, said that they never ordered the Department of Education to resume payments to Feeding Our Future in April of 2021. And so my question is, who made that decision? So let's get some clarity. Who made that decision? And my question, and hopefully we're able to gain some guidance here. This had been going on, the complaints had been going on at this point for 16 months, 18, 20 months at this point, based upon the timelines. So by this time, I'm seeking to find out, was the governor's office involved? Who made the decision? If you don't know, can you share with us who would have been involved in that decision? Was it the commissioner of the department? Was it the governor's chief of staff? Was it the governor? Who was involved in this decision to return to payments in April of 2021, specifically April 21st?
Ms. Holden.
Thank you, Representative and Chair Robbins. And at April 21st, 2021 was when there was a hearing in front of Judge Guffman, and it related not to the stop payments, but it related to the lawsuit that FOF had filed in November of 2020, challenging that we were not processing their site applications quickly enough because we had concerns about the sites they were applying for. And FOF sued, and the AG's office represented us in that litigation. Then in January and again in March of 2021, MDE initiated two different series deficiency processes against Feeding Our Future. The second one in March is when we started the
Madam
stop
Chair.
Payments.
Yes, Representative Schultz.
Who made the decision? That's the question. Not everything else you're talking about. Who made the decision?
Ms. Holden.
Representative and Chair Robbins, excuse me for the context. It's The piece about that April, what I wanted to say about that April 21st hearing is that during that hearing, which was about the site applications, FOF itself brought up the stop payments that had been imposed 3 weeks prior. And what the judge said was, this is not before me, but I welcome you to file an amendment to your complaint so that it is before me. And I'm inclined to agree that you don't have the authority to issue the stop payments.
Madam Chair.
Representative Schultz.
On April 30th, 9 days later, MDE removed its stop pay order on feeding Our Futures account within its claims processing system. MDE removed the stop pay order due to the court statements on April 21st, 2021, is what the OLA report says, despite what Judge Guthman says. So who made the decision?
Representative and Chair Robbins.
Yes.
So MDE made the decision to stop the payments. Like I said, Judge Guthman indicated that he did not believe we had the authority to do stop payments. And welcomed a procedural move by FOF to get the issue in front of him so he could address it directly. And just to your,
Thank you. Last question, Representative Schultz.
A letter saying the opposite.
Right. He then put out a statement contradicting the governor's statement, saying the governor at the time said that the judge had ordered them to stop payments. And the judge issued a very rare statement saying, no, that is not what he said, and really sort of shut down the governor on that. So I just want that to be clear for the public on the record, that the judge did not order the stop payments, and that when the governor stated that, that was in error.
Madam Chair, thank you, Madam Chair, that's why it's important to know who made this decision. At the end of the day, as Minnesotans seek accountability, we need to know who made the decision. Was it the governor himself? That is the question. Was it the governor himself who decided for these payments to continue amidst these fraud allegations? And we have yet to get that answer. And we've been sent people who weren't even there when it happened.
Representative, Madam Chair, do you want me to respond?
Very quickly, we have more people on the list.
Representative, Madam Chair, I will just reiterate, as I said previously, it was an MDE decision about the change in the stop payments.
Thank you. Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you. Well, MDE would never make a decision like that without contacting and getting complete clarity from the governor's office, at least in every other administration I know. So, so I have a copy of the stipulation agreement, the one that, okay, they went to court, and I'm not even sure how or why this was negotiated in the first place, they went to court ultimately over this, that they weren't doing what they had said they would do within the stipulation. Do you know who helped negotiate this? Was this the Attorney General's office? Who is the attorney for the Department of, all departments?
Ms. Halden.
Representative and Chair Robbins, as a general matter, if there's a legal matter that we're engaged in that's involved in litigation, the AG's office serves as our counsel.
Thank you, Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you. So I assume that with this. Was the AG's office, you keep saying that it was the department, which means the administration, which means the governor's office, that made the decision to withhold or to start payments again. But was that at the advice of the Attorney General?
Ms. Halden.
Who is the attorney for MDE?
Representative Chair Robbins, this is not going to be a satisfactory answer, but certain how decisions about litigation are come to between counsel and a client are subject to attorney-client privilege. And so kind of the ins and outs, I wasn't there, but B, I wouldn't be able to get into it.
Yes, I'm sorry, that is not true. Just for the record, MDE has the authority to waive the privilege. The privilege is yours to waive. The Attorney General cannot waive the privilege. You may waive the privilege. And back in September 27th of 2022, then Leader Kurt Dowd called on MDE to waive the privilege so we could get answers to these questions back then. So you cannot hide behind attorney-client privilege in this hearing. You can waive the privilege at any point.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Anderson.
We only have 10 minutes left, so I want to keep
Representative Nash.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And Ms. Holden, I feel for you. You were not there at the time, and yet you're here today, and you're catching some of our ire. I did have a question for you about something you just said a little bit ago, that you reached out to the federal level OIGs for help as to how to investigate and so on. And I like being able to see things and read them so that I can better understand them. Would you be able to provide that to the committee so that we don't have to do a data request? But would you send that over as to that departmental request? Because I don't think I've ever seen that. I'd be really curious to see just how much effort was put into raising a hand asking for outside help, because that's, I think, a very salient point to this whole issue that we've been talking about, is just how much effort went into getting to the bottom of Feeding Our Future and other scandals that happened around that. Just, you know, you weren't there, so it's not your work product, but if you would mind getting us by end of the week, if you could, I think that would be very helpful to understanding just the totality of what happened as it relates to uncovering what happened, because there's a lot of things that people have to answer for. And when you made that statement, I thought it would be nice to see that we actually raised a hand and said, and this is me reading into it, we feel like we're way out of our element, we're in the deep end of the pool, help us out. I've never heard that before, so when you said that, it caught my interest. So could we expect that of you by the end of the week?
Representative Chair Robbins, we would absolutely, like, we can work to pull that together. I don't know if end of the week, but we will do our very best. And one thing I will say about it is that my understanding is that some of the interactions were meetings, so they may not have detailed kind of notes, but we will see what we can find, and we will send that along. I know that there are at least a couple emails.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Representative Nash.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, if you know that they happened, there has to be a record of them somewhere, because you very clearly have said that you weren't there at the time. So somewhere there has to be a record of that, and one would hope that detailed record keeping was in effect that day. So thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Halton, okay. Thank you. I did also want to ask for something. So we had also invited for this afternoon Darren Court, who was there at the time, oversaw the program, was not able to attend, and I would like to follow up with him. But we are under, we have found through court documents that MDE staff signed an affidavit saying that USDA told them they could issue the stop payment. So there must be a record of an affidavit that was signed, and we would like to see that. Thank you.
Chair Robbins, we will see what we can do.
Excellent.
And apologies, Ms. Assistant Commissioner Cordy is in Lexington, Kentucky at the Military Interstate Compact Executive Committee retreat, so he couldn't be here today.
Yes, very unfortunate. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is more of a comment, because I think much of this is rehashing things that I remember hearing about in education finance, both the audit report and the response a couple of years ago. And as we talk about both accountability and also what I think our role should be here is being curious about, one, what we have done in the last couple of years and how it has responded to and fixed the problem, which I have heard none of. I heard it from MDE, but I actually have not heard any engagement from your side on the last 2 years of learning once we heard this report 2 years ago. So it makes me question the work here. But when we talk about accountability, like, I am glad that we have new leadership at MDE. And 2 years ago, we talked about needing new leadership at MDE. You can't have it both ways. You can't be upset that it's not the same leadership at MDE and then call for accountability. So what I will say is, actually, what we have both heard and seen, and what I've heard and seen when I was on education finance towards the end and now, is we passed a law to give a general counsel. We passed a law to give an OIG, which I think that the OIG proposal that you're proposing would eliminate. But, and then we heard from MDE here how it has been working and how it has given them new powers, including new powers that the OLA said in their report 2 years ago that they wanted. And so I guess in the limited time that we have left in this committee, we have, again, my goal, I feel like our goal should be, instead of rehashing for the campaign trail, which I know is coming up, is actually looking at the structures and the systems, one, that we have been talking about for years, and then looking at what the legislative interventions are that can improve those outcomes. So it would have been nice here to have more conversation, and I guess we only have 5 minutes left, but I guess I'm the first person to ask about how having an OIG within MDE and a general counsel has actually and would have changed how you could have responded to this, Representative Anderson, that wasn't a question for you, that was a question for MDE. But given that we have changed structures in response to a lot of this conversation that our colleagues have been having, how has the Inspector General's office within MDE that we did not have during the feeder future timeline that we went through, how does having a general counsel's office that we did not have through this timeline, how has that changed and impacted your ability to both oversee the very bifurcated system we still have and the federal government has still set up, and to engage on these from MDE and not having to rely on the Inspector General's office at the federal level, which clearly fell down on the job here?
Ms. Holden.
Representative Chair Robbins, thank you for the question. This has been the story of what we've been working on since I came to MDE last year and before then. I think the thing I'll start with, because I know a lot of members had a question about kind of stop payments, is that was a real, we now, under our, with our OIG, have two things. One is a strong expert investigative team who both knows our program areas very well and has their own law enforcement background. And they can conduct investigations and make determinations about either credible allegations of fraud or findings by preponderance of fraud, which would allow us to meet that rare suspend language in the federal nutrition regs that we didn't have the tools to on our own before. So that's one piece of it. The other piece is that our OIG, the language that you all passed as a follow-up in 2024 after establishing our MDE OIG in 2023 includes independent sanction authorities for our commissioner and our OIG that includes both temporary sanctions and permanent sanctions. And so that is another option, and we have been using those sanctions when our OIG encounters fraud. So I think those are two really key pieces. The other thing is that having our OIG at MDE has just allowed for an incredible, them learning our program areas, knowing them very well, because the nutrition regs are so complex and a little bit not what you would expect, as I've outlined. It takes a while for team members to really figure out what is a violation of this program. When is a sponsor not following the rules? So our OIG now knows that, and they are in constant collaboration with the program areas that are referring situations over there to OIG to make sure that they're looking into it. But when that happens, our OIG can also give feedback to our program areas and say, you know what, like here is something you could try. Here is something we noticed, and you could try to make that better. And so I think it's really strengthening the internal controls and the effective oversight of our program areas to have our OIG be able to give them feedback. The other piece with regard to Office of General Counsel is that, again, we have our own in-house lawyers that can both provide kind of a full interpretation of what we might be able to do with the regs, and then make sure that as we're using them, we're doing steps along the way that are making sure that the decisions that we make and the regulatory actions that we take are defensible when they are challenged. And they are frequently challenged. As you heard Mr. Glahn reference, the Gargar case, the Pinn case, that Pinn took that to the Minnesota Court of Appeals up until last summer. And we thanks to the Minnesota Court of Appeals, or the Minnesota Supreme Court, excuse me, not taking the case, we were finally able to permanently disqualify Pinn and all of its principles from the federal nutrition programs altogether.
If I could ask,
She's wasting time.
So why were they not prosecuted? So disqualifying them from these federal programs is inadequate, in my view. Why were Gargar and
question for the U.S. Attorney?
I know the U.S. Attorney could, but the Attorney General could have brought civil cases to try to recover the money.
He's using the word prosecution, which is a criminal.
I understand. I do understand. But there could have been civil litigation, and they could have tried to recover the funds, and they did not. Do you know why those cases weren't taken up?
Chair Robbins, I don't. I'm here on behalf of MDE.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Oh, we have to close it. I just want to say a couple of things. There's been the internal OIG has been there for 2 years, 3 years. Okay. During a big chunk of that time, that position was vacant, and most of them were. We also know that from a variety of reasons that the OIG has had been heavily influenced by the commissioner and the governor's office. In fact, stopped doing things early on, things that they were supposed to do. The OIG, if we are going to get to the bottom of the fraud, if we're going to actually have oversight, the OIG has to be independent. Okay, independent. And that's what this bill is about. That is what is being proposed. That's what passed the Senate. That is where all the negotiation, we've had the internal discussion legislatively in depth. But the OIG needs to be independent within these agencies. And I'm glad there's more oversight. I'm glad there's a focus with the new commissioner, whoever, that there's more focus on actually doing the regulatory job that government entities should be doing. Okay, I'm glad of that. But we have a very, the legislature has very different bipartisan, okay, image of what's happened there, okay, than what you're espousing. So I just want you to know that. So
thank you.
Lead, we are out of time. So
Lead Pinto.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, I know that it's time's tight here. I'll be real quick. I just wanted to ask, we just need to be careful as we move through this that we're being fair and accurate at each stage. So OLA found some significant failures of MDE, not challenging those at all. And there's huge concern with this, with what happened here. And at the same time, when I look at the timeline, I'm seeing a lot of effort by MDE to address the concerns that was being seen in Feeding Our Future, including working with the FBI right as that court hearing was going on. I've appeared in front of Judge Guthman. I know the message that apparently was given at that hearing was, listen, pretty quick here, I will in fact be ruling to stop payments. That doesn't mean it was the right call, the wrong call, or anything, but I'll just note that matters can get complicated when you're making those decisions. But what I see is a lot of efforts by the agency to stop the payment. Ultimately, if we're concerned, you know, the request to the AG's office was to provide information on prosecutions. That's not an area of expertise for them or jurisdiction. If there's something else that our committee is interested in, we want to make a different request there. The folks who do have authority for the prosecutions, we know is the U.S. Attorney's Office. And unfortunately, that's an office that's been gutted because you've had a lot of attorneys resigning because they've been pushed into unethical actions by the Trump administration. And that's a huge threat when it comes to federally funded programs, not just in the food program, but in Medicaid as well. So sort of that's when you think about our kind of federal connection here, that is the big federal connection of the work of our committee, and especially for this particular situation. So I'm glad that we made the effort to feed kids, and it's awful the way that things worked out with this program, and I'm very glad there have been a lot of prosecutions. We need a lot more going on, and we need that U.S. Attorney's Office back up and running. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Lee Pinto, and thank you to all the testifiers who've been with us today. Thank you to the members. I just want to close. This will be our last hearing on Feeding Our Future, and I think what we hope the public understands is that it was broader than this one case. There was another at least $250 million that has not been prosecuted either by the U.S. Attorney or by the Attorney General in civil litigation, and there were numerous times when the Attorney General was serving as counsel for MDE, where these decisions were made, and he was not here to answer those questions of how he represented, and MDE still has not chosen to waive privilege so we can get these answers. And the failures of the U.S. Department of Agriculture Inspector General apparently happened under the Biden administration, which also turned a blind eye. With that, we are adjourned.